Hi, everybody. Good evening. So tonight's assignment is to think about Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik on prayer and how we might situate his understanding of prayer in his larger understanding of, actually I'll say, human life in general and spiritual life in particular. And I want to begin with a couple of sort of prefatory comments about prayer in 20th century Jewish thought that will tie to a little bit of what we talked about last week, but is also a standalone. And then some thoughts about Soloveitchik himself, and then finally moving directly into the question of prayer and Soloveitchik's thought. The first thing I want to say is that there is a very interesting shift that to many of us is so self-evident that we actually don't think about how dramatic a shift it represents. And that is that among many 20th century Jewish thinkers, the center of gravity in theologizing about prayer moves from what will God do as a response to my prayer to what is the inherently transformative potential of the act of my praying in the first place. Right? Is that clear? Right? In other words, it's no longer an issue of I pray, and prayer works, as it were, if and when God responds to my prayer, but rather there becomes, among many Jewish thinkers, this shift such that the real issue is in praying before God, something transformative inherently happens. Now, of course, the cynical reading of this is, well, in a century in which you find it hard to theologize about whether, let alone how, God is actively responding to the prayer of people in need, this is what you do. You sort of rationalize by shifting the center of gravity elsewhere, right? In a less cynical frame, you might imagine that as a kind of religious maturation, right? That rather than it being this kind of almost cash and carry model of, I pray, and then God gives me what I ask for, somehow the act of prayer is, in some fundamental way, a reflexive act, right? It's an act of self-transformation in some way, right? It's done in the presence of God, but it's not, or to be more exact, it's not primarily focused on what God will do in response. You find that, to talk about the people we've been talking about, both in Heschel and in Soloveitchik. Heschel, to quote something that I didn't talk about last week, makes this comment as a throwaway, really, in the preface to his book, Man's Quest for God. He says, prayer may not save us, but prayer makes us worthy of being saved. Prayer may not save us, but prayer makes us worthy of being saved. In other words, the issue is not what God is going to do, but rather how I am shaped and transformed, or to refer back to last week, the way in which I learn to self-transcend in the moment of prayer. If you recall what we talked about Heschel, it's actually the case that gravity has shifted 180 degrees to totally destroy metaphors, right? That is, right, it's no longer a question of what will God do in response to my prayer, but rather what will I do for God in the act of praying, right? If you remember how we ended last time, the notion of prayer as opening a space for divine immanence in the world, right? Less ego, more God. So actually, instead of an interest in how is God going to do something for me as a response to prayer, the actual claim is, or the interest is, how can I, in the very act of praying, do something for God? How can I, through the act of praying, transform myself and transform the world in such a way that God is now allowed in? Now, just as a sort of footnote to this observation I've made about some 20th century Jewish thinkers, I want to point out that these are not thinkers who you would necessarily say, oh, I would expect them to do that. Meaning, they're not, I'm going to speak a shorthand here, which I'll explain if I have to, they are not liberal Protestant Jews. Meaning, they are not Jews who have radically reimagined what God is to such an extent that, well, of course God's not going to intervene because I don't believe in that kind of God anyway, right? In the case of Heschel and Soloveitchik, we're talking about two people who actually believe in an omnipotent God. And yet they, even they, shift the center of gravity away from what will God do to how will the act of praying be transformative for me. I think it's actually very significant. This is not a move that's limited to sort of self-described liberal theology. What we're going to essentially do tonight is look at a very interesting example of this. I would actually sort of suggest one of the most interesting and sort of bold versions of this in 20th century Jewish thought, an essay by Joseph Soloveitchik called Redemption Prayer Talmud Torah. Okay, so now just a few general comments about Soloveitchik, whose dates, by the way, 1903 to 1993, and I think it's, you know, unquestionably, one can say, the most important Orthodox thinker in 20th century North American Orthodoxy. The only reason I say North American Orthodoxy is because in Israel, that sort of position is held by Rav Kook. Sort of interesting culturally, by the way, that if you look at American Orthodoxy and you refer to the Rav, right, the rabbi, that means Rabbi Soloveitchik. But if you're in Israel and someone says Harav, that refers to Rav Kook. And if you come to the Zionism lectures in the spring, you will discover just how dramatically different their worldviews really are. Orthodoxy is a very capacious word. Now, what makes Soloveitchik, I think, such an interesting modern thinker, and a thoroughly modern thinker, is that he marries in a way that is, I think, quite, it is bold, it is imaginative. Whether it's successful is an open question, but he marries a really deep commitment to halakha and tradition and their authority on the one hand, and on the other hand, a thoroughly modern preoccupation with freedom, creativity, individuality, and attendantly, a kind of preoccupation with the problem of alienation. Right? His concerns are profoundly modern, and not only to reject modernity, but actually, and this is, you know, I think one of the sort of boldest moves in 20th century theology, to actually claim that all of those values are already built into the tradition itself. And we'll as we proceed, we'll talk about that, and then during the give and take afterwards, maybe we'll be able to talk about it more. Or to sort of maybe say this in a slightly different way, Soloveitchik attempts this sort of grand synthesis of, on the one hand, the authority of halakha, and on the other hand, an unapologetically existentialist interpretation of the human condition. The human being as fundamentally thrown, vulnerable, lost, or to use my favorite phrase in all of his writings, bereft of an ontic fulcrum. Now, if you wonder what bereft of an ontic fulcrum means, I once had a t-shirt made by Old Navy is that an ontic fulcrum in your pocket? Okay. Bereft of an ontic fulcrum means, in other words, I really have that t-shirt. Bereft of an ontic fulcrum actually means, very simply, not having a sense of equilibrium or groundedness, right? Being sort of lost in the world, being thrown, being vulnerable, not being grounded. And one of the things that happens as a result of this attempt at a grand synthesis between the authority of tradition on the one hand and the categories of existentialism on the other hand is that Rabbi Soloveitchik engages in what I would call an existentialization of some of the basic categories of Jewish theology. What do I mean by that? If you were to read carefully one of Soloveitchik's classic essays, Isha Halakha, Halachic Man, you would discover that, lo and behold, the central preoccupation of Jewish theology and spirituality is man as creator of worlds and man as self-creator. So the category of Briah, creation, which for the medieval philosophers is really a category that's a discussion of how did the world come into being, for Soloveitchik it is much more fundamentally a kind of normative category that is about how do I as a human being function in the world as an agent. And tshuva, which you might think means something like apologizing to God for my sins and promising to do better, right? For Soloveitchik comes to mean the process of fashioning a new self, becoming the author of my own existence, being an agent. What will be central for us is that he will do something that is extremely dramatic and potentially has huge consequences for Jewish theology that he does not address or at least publicly even think about, and that is the transformation of the category of redemption from primarily a political, social category, that is, a category about the future unfolding of the life of the Jewish people, or, in its more universalist iterations, a category about the transformation and future of the human race. He will transform it from that to a category that describes the condition of an individual soul in the present, what we might call Geulat HaYachid, the redemption of the individual soul in this historical circumstance. Now, just one methodological point I want to make before we proceed into this essay. We can't do with Soloveitchik what we did with Heschel. Meaning, with Heschel, I think it's fair to say, with a few minor exceptions here and there, Heschel's corpus can be read as one huge synchronic whole. Right? Heschel's theology is continuous from his earliest works to his last works. It's a sort of a theology where Einu Damu Muchar BaTorah. There's really no early Heschel, no late Heschel. Again, there's a few tweaks here and there, but it really is this sort of unified corpus of writing. Soloveitchik's corpus is in many ways the very opposite. There is a tremendous amount of disagreement among people who read Soloveitchik about whether, let alone how, all of his various essays can be read as kind of constituting some kind of whole. Right? You will not find anyone who has tried to write, for example, a fully synthetic, here's how the lonely man of faith maps onto halachic man, and how they each map onto Uvikashtem Misham and various other classic essays of Soloveitchik. It's not clear to me that it can be done, but it's clear to me that it hasn't been done. In other words, I think Soloveitchik was much less interested in having a theology of Judaism than Heschel was. Meaning, if you were to buy Man is Not Alone, you would see that Heschel calls it a philosophy of religion. And to buy God in Search of Man, he calls it a philosophy of Judaism. What he means by the word philosophy, I don't know. But, right, a philosophy of religion, a philosophy of Judaism, right? Soloveitchik in a million years, I don't think would have ever written a book with that sort of synthetic, ambitious a title. Soloveitchik did something more like what I would call snapshots. Right? He was interested in sort of capturing aspects of the religious life as he understood it. Or just to be sort of gratuitously pretentious, right? I would say what Soloveitchik does is autophenomenology. Right? He is sort of portraying what his religious consciousness looks like in a particular moment, at a particular circumstance, through reading particular texts. So, for example, what does this mean? This means that if you were to set out in front of you Soloveitchik's 7 essays on prayer, I'm not sure that you would even know they were written by the same person, let alone that you would be clear afterwards, okay, here's a theology of prayer according to Joseph Soloveitchik. I'm not convinced it can be done, and again, I'm not convinced he was interested in that. In that sense, this is maybe a cheap sense, he's much more postmodern than Heschel is, right? He's actually just windows. Windows into the spiritual life and what it might look like. So, because of that, the heart of what I want to try to talk about in the next little while is actually an individual essay, which I think raises a lot of issues that appear and reappear throughout Soloveitchik's writings, but we will spend most of our time on a few passages from this one essay from 1978, Redemption, Prayer, Talmud Torah. All of that said, there are a couple of themes that do seem to sort of weave through all of Soloveitchik's writings. And I want to just briefly lay the groundwork about one of them. And as I said last week about Wunder and Heschel, if you want to sort of hear a more developed version of this, there are various iterations of my talks about that on the website. But I want to just sort of say a couple of words about what I think is arguably the animating theme that pervades Soloveitchik's writing, and that is what he calls creation, or what we might call creativity. Part two of Halachic Man is about the notion of the human being as creator, and it is a really interesting attempt to subvert, I think, what both critics of halachic traditionalism on the one hand and proponents of halachic traditionalism on the other might argue about halacha. Right? That is, the second part of Halachic Man is an argument that you might have thought that halacha was about cultivating a posture of obedience, uniformity, maybe even passivity. But actually, Soloveitchik argues, the mandate, the project of halacha is about eliciting agency, freedom, human being as co-creator, about making the human being God's partner in the creation and repair of the world. That, he argues, is the, what I have called, he does not use this word, but I think it captures what he's after, the ethos of halacha is about the human being as creator. And in fact, one of the great innovations in Soloveitchik's theology is the claim that that is the highest form of the imitation of God. V'halachta bidrachav, right? For the rabbis of the Talmud, v'halachta bidrachav, it's one of the few things the rabbis of the Talmud are basically univocal, unanimous about, right? Walking in God's ways is about chesed, is about acts of loving kindness. Soloveitchik makes the case, right, that actually v'halachta bidrachav, walking in God's ways, is about just as God is the creator of worlds, so must you be creator of worlds. And that is the height of the spiritual life. The height of the spiritual life is the human being becoming like God, a creator. Or to give another, I think, magnificent example of using halachic language to express existentialist thoughts, Soloveitchik says at one point that the goal of halacha is to take a human being and transform them from a cheftza to a gavra, from an object to a subject, from a mere object to actually someone who is constituted by personhood. And how is that done? Through cultivating agency, the ability to act in the world. So, footnote to this, by the way, that is, I have argued, the logic that enables Soloveitchik later on to abandon family tradition and become a Zionist. Right? For him, that's about a kind of existentialist logic that says what's true for a person is also true for a people. Just as a person is, when spiritually mature, not allowed to be passive, so also a people, when mature, are not allowed to be passive but have to become active. That's the philosophical structure that makes it possible for him to become a Zionist. So when people say, for example, Soloveitchik becomes a Zionist after World War II, one has to make, I think, a very kind of basic distinction between what precipitates that transformation and what philosophically undergirds it. Right? What precipitates it is the discovery of how urgent he thinks those issues are, the reclamation of Jewish power. Right? But what facilitates it, makes it possible, is a prior preoccupation with having a sense of agency and not being passive in the world. Okay, now, beginning to transition towards the prayer issue specifically, arguably, the culmination of the theme of the human being as creator is the notion of the human being as self-creator. That is the meaning of tshuva, according to Soloveitchik. Or to say this in sort of traditional Jewish theological language, tshuva, for Soloveitchik, is a subcategory of briah. Right? Repentance is a kind of manifestation of a more fundamental, overarching commitment to creativity. Just as I create worlds, I have to create myself. And there's a kind of implicit spiritual assumption there that to attempt to disentangle those two is actually impossible, right? To be committed to the transformation of the world without the transformation of the self is a prescription for disaster of various kinds. And to be committed to the transformation of the self without being interested in the transformation of the world is to descend into spirituality as narcissism, right? Oh, the world can rot in hell, but isn't my soul beautiful, right? Is that in a way that he wants to avoid? And strikingly for a thinker who describes himself and is described as a sort of classically orthodox figure, at least in Halachic Man, the emphasis is dramatically on just how much a human being can accomplish by him or herself in the act of self-transformation. There is almost no appeal to the divine grace that is necessary to make change possible. Or to use language from one contemporary Israeli rabbi, right? Tshuva for Soloveitchik in Halachic Man is a matter of chayrut, not chesed. Right? It is a function of human freedom and action rather than, oh, I'll just pray hard and then God will fix me in some way. You find that kind of language in other of Soloveitchik's essay. Refer back to what I said before about continuity and discontinuity in his writing. But in Halachic Man, here, okay, without kind of disintegrating into a 20th century intellectual history, here Soloveitchik betrays how carefully he's read the German philosopher Hermann Cohen, right? Where one becomes a self in the act of taking responsibility for the ways one has failed. That's when one has an I for the first time. You become a self in taking responsibility for yourself. Okay, so now we're ready to turn to the theme of prayer more specifically. And in this essay, Soloveitchik goes even farther, right? You could imagine a theology that says, God is the creator of worlds, therefore, you should not even have the first thought of being a creator of worlds, because God is God and you are not. But the logic, as we've seen in Soloveitchik, is the opposite. It's the logic of the Metatio Dei that says, God is the creator of worlds, so should you. When it comes to prayer, Soloveitchik will say something one step more dramatic. He will say that a human being is not just a self-creator, but also, in some really profound, basic way, self-redeemer. That is, in other words, if until now we saw the theme that God creates worlds, and the human being therefore creates worlds and selves, now we see that man is charged with the task of redeeming his own soul. Now, I keep saying his, by the way, because unlike in the case of Heschel, I'm not totally sure. No, let me say this in a reverse way. I'm fairly confident about Heschel that had he lived 20 years longer, he would have shifted his language in a more gender-sensitive way. I'm less confident about that about Soloveitchik, and it requires sort of thinking about, right? In other words, is Soloveitchik's vision of halachic woman a mirror in some ways of halachic man or not at all? Now, that said, that does not mean that one should not make one's own conclusions about how one would use Soloveitchik's thought, even if he wouldn't have used it that way. To use a distinction that I always sort of talk about, especially with summer fellows, the distinction between being a Soloveitchikian and a neo-Soloveitchikian, right? No, I mean that quite seriously. Meaning, I think you should be honest about what Soloveitchik would not have gone along for the ride with, right? To actually understand a thinker in his or her own terms, but then also to think about what material is there to be taken in different directions than the thinker, him or herself, would be willing to go. I mean, I think that's what you do when you're not just an intellectual historian and not just interested in making midrash. But when you're actually interested in understanding a thinker and how we might learn from them, you're in this constant give and take between figuring out what did they mean and what material is there that we might take in a different direction than they might have taken. So I make that comment about Soloveitchik because I'm talking about him now. I'm not talking about how we might reappropriate him. That's what I'm struggling with around gender up here is that. Okay. So the notion that the human being has to redeem their own soul. The essay, Redemption, Prayer, Talmud Torah, is a kind of extended meditation on one line of Talmud. The Talmud in Masechet Brachot quotes a sage as saying that one who is somech geula l'tfila muftach lo shehu ben ha'olam haba. One who links up redemption and prayer, and tefillah, usually in rabbinic literature, when it's simply the noun tefillah, refers to the Amida, right? So one who links redemption and the Amida is guaranteed that he has a share in the world to come. That line is halacha lemaaseh. That line is actually how Jewish law traditionally functions. That's why we don't pause between Ga'al Yisrael and the Amida, at least in Shacharit, right? That's where that, in case you're wondering, right, that's where that very strange, relatively recent custom of the Chazan swallowing the last words of Ga'al Yisrael came from. That is, in order to preclude the congregation saying Amen, and thereby creating a rupture, a break, between Ga'al Yisrael and the Amida. Now, Soloveitchik operates with a premise here. The premise is, there's got to be some kind of value idea here. There's got to be some kind of theology here. What is this obsession with Geula L'Tfila? This is not some random norm that makes no sense. But, like many statements in rabbinic literature, it's sort of this sort of aphoristic comment without any elaboration. And Soloveitchik takes it upon himself to offer a kind of midrashic, homiletical, theological elaboration of what is the intrinsic tie between redemption on the one hand and prayer on the other. Why would, and implicitly, although he never actually says this, implicitly, what might the rabbis mean by saying that a person who links redemption and prayer has a share in the world to come? What is going on there? So if you look at the packet I gave you, and this essay, by the way, if you Google it, you can download the whole essay for free from the Tradition magazine website. I just gave a few pages here. If you look at the first paragraph that I've isolated on page 56 for a second, Soloveitchik says, redemption, we have stated, is identical with communing, or with the revelation of the word, the emergence of speech. And then, if you skip to where I've underlined for us, a mute life is identical with bondage, a speech-endowed life is a free life. Now, already here, the heart of Soloveitchik's claim is clear, and it is totally dramatic, and he's going to spend the rest of the time sort of fleshing it out. That is, redemption equals the capacity for speech. Redemption is constituted by the capacity for speech. What it means to be a slave, he claims, is to have no words. Politically, it's about not being allowed to have a story. Existentially, it's about internalizing that oppression, such that I don't feel I have a story. Maybe, at one stage, I have pain, but Soloveitchik claims I don't yet have suffering until I have words to describe my pain. So the claim is that it's only in the moment of learning how to speak, it is only there, it is there and only there, at least according to the logic of this essay, that redemption emerges. I become free in the moment that I speak. And I would just ask, even before we go on, to people to think about for now, we'll talk about this, I hope, later, how would you evaluate this claim? How would you make sense of it, psychologically, spiritually? Does it make sense of, resonate with, whatever the language of slavery, imprisonment on the one hand, and freedom, liberation on the other, would mean personally? Now, I don't want to make any, and I don't think he wants to either, any sort of facile equations where, you know, some people are oppressed, degraded, and starving in the third world, but I am oppressed by my upper middle class habits on the west side, right? I don't think he wants that kind of facile equivalence. But he does want to claim that there is some aspect of human experience that constitutes enslavement, even amidst enormous political freedom. And I actually have a feeling he would argue there are different and unique forms of enslavement that emerge dafka specifically in context of political freedom and especially economic opportunity. But imagine, just to personalize this for a second, the difference between, we'll start with a negative sense, the difference between feeling a deep but inchoate sense of hurt or loneliness on the one hand, and then to make up a word, making that hurt or loneliness coate, right? Actually finding a way to begin to find language for the kind of hurt and loneliness you carry. Soloveitchik's claim is that psychologically and spiritually speaking, in the moment that I discover the words for what it is that I need and am suffering from, I am in some crucial way already redeemed. Now, if you think back to how I started with this sort of description of 20th century theology of prayers, at least in the case of Soloveitchik and Heschel and probably others, you already see what he's doing here, right? You can anticipate the whole logic, the trajectory of this essay, which is redemption is not something that I wait for once I articulate my needs, but redemption is something I accomplish in the process of expressing those needs. That's the project of the essay. Right? Is in the moment of speaking my needs, I've already achieved something crucial on the path towards redemption. Now, in other words, if we were to say this less melodramatically, we could say, right, that in finding words, in some sense, we have already removed at least some of the sting of those things which oppress us. Some of the sting has been taken out by the ability to use contemporary idiom that I don't really like, naming the things that oppress us. Okay, now, just let's just stop for a second and see how radical this is, okay? Traditional Jewish theology teaches the following. Redemption will happen, A, collectively, B, in the future. Right? That's a fairly straightforward description of what Geula is in Jewish theology. Soloveitchik here, again following Hermann Cohen, teaches that redemption can also happen A, individually, and B, in the present. He has maybe some Kabbalistic precedent for this, but not lots. Right? He has individualized, and he has made the claim that the future redemption is available in some sense now. That also is a trope in 20th century Jewish thought. You have versions of this in Franz Rosenzweig, arguably in Martin Buber, the notion that somehow the future can be tapped into in the present. It always sort of drives me a little crazy when people say things about Soloveitchik, like one of Soloveitchik's family members in his constant need to sort of revisionistically make Soloveitchik totally continuous with everything that came before, says, Soloveitchik says nothing theologically that his grandfather wouldn't have recognized. I mean, I can't even offer you a coherent explanation of what that argument would mean, right? That's how wrong it is. In other words, right, maybe in the question and answer we have a conversation about the ways in which Heschel and Soloveitchik both have generated a lot of legacy of people who want to fight about what they did mean, what they didn't mean, who they were, who they weren't, how integral these ideas were. Soloveitchik here is very much doing something rather dramatic. Okay. Now, there's a danger here. And I want to put this out there as just a sort of thought for us to play with. Does equating redemption with speech render the objective reality of our situation less important? Right? In other words, does it take away the incentive to change societal, economic, political oppression? If I am politically or psychologically oppressed, but able to speak about my needs and pain, am I redeemed despite my objective circumstance? And I suspect Soloveitchik would say, I suspect. Well, yes and no. right? I'm not talking about this, I think he would say, although he doesn't say it, right? I'm not talking about this as an instead of, right? This is not redeem your soul and let Rome burn, right? This is actually something like it's possible to be free even amidst oppression, and I suspect, I don't know if this is him or me talking, I just want to underline that, that if you take that freedom seriously, it can't but translate into the reality of the world as well. The example I always think about in this context is, if you've ever read Frederick Douglass's autobiographies, right? By the time Frederick Douglass learns how to read, he's already gone. He's not a slave anymore. I mean, he's a slave, but he's not a slave. He's already a free man. That's when he says in The Narrative of the Life of a Slave by Frederick Douglass, "You have seen how a man was made a slave, now you will see how a slave was made a man." The moment he learns to read and to express himself, he's basically already been redeemed. The reason I invoke that is because Frederick Douglass doesn't then say, "Okay, I'm redeemed. Fine, I'll let my master beat me." He says, "I'm already redeemed, therefore I'm leaving." Now again, Soloveitchik doesn't go there. But otherwise, this is a kind of unimaginably quietistic essay from a deeply non-quietistic thinker. Right? It has to be the case that the inner transformation manifests as some kind of outer transformation as well. Now, in contemporary Israeli terms, some Zionist intellectuals, some religious Zionist intellectuals, have said, you know, this is a kind of weak point in Soloveitchik's theology. They kind of turn around Gershom Scholem's famous comment. Some of you may know that Gershom Scholem famously offered this critique of the damage that Messianism does. The damage that Messianism does, there are all kinds of damage it does, but one in particular that it does in his mind is it forces us, he says, it forces Jews to live life in deferment. Right? Either they spend all their time waiting for the future, or they spend all their time dreaming of the way the past will be restored. But they can't actually live in the present. Judaism, Jewish messianism as a kind of anti-mindfulness practice. Right? It's all about looking to other times. Right? And so sort of Scholem worries about whether it robbed Jews of the ability to live in the present fully. Israeli philosopher Dov Schwartz asked the question whether Soloveitchik actually accomplishes the exact opposite, right? That is, if you existentialize the category of redemption and make it totally personal and inward, have you stripped away from redemption precisely the political, social aspiration that is central to it, right? Now again, that's the answer, that's the question I've been trying to address by saying I think Soloveitchik would say, no, you actually empower people to behave differently in history. But the question is very real. Or to put it more crudely, as some scholars sort of gingerly put it about Soloveitchik, doesn't he end up sounding like what many Jews traditionally accuse Christianity of? Oh, salvation of my soul. That's what's interesting. Again, I don't think that's fair to Christianity or Soloveitchik, but the question is important to raise. Right? What are the consequences of where you place your point of emphasis? What are the consequences of that, either for forgetting the individual, or conversely for abandoning the future? Okay, now, Soloveitchik makes the claim in a passage we won't read at any length, in the second passage on 60 and 61, that one may exist, this is a quote, one may existentially be a slave in the midst of political and economic freedoms. And the claim he's going to go on to make actually is that, unlike Heschel, he does not constantly invoke the notion that it's modernity gone awry. But he's going to make the claim that actually the culture of advertising gone crazy is precisely what makes us be imprisoned to needs we feel we have and can't ever fully meet, and leaves us feeling thereby totally oppressed. And actually, he'll go somewhere further, which is, it actually gives us a false list of needs. And that's, by the way, if you want to look for the place of where the category of alienation, although he doesn't use it, emerges, it's that modern man, in his mind, has internalized a set of aspirations that are fundamentally foreign to what it authentically means to be human. That is, we want stuff. And here, you can hear the resonances with what we talked about in Heschel last time, right? Acquisitiveness as constituting a false self. Now, again, you can see where all this is going. If you articulate your needs, in the very act of articulating them, or better, in the very act of articulating them to God, you are already free of the sense of oppression. Now, implicit here, as we saw in Heschel also, is this very kind of live idea of the true versus the false self. This is, you find this in modern religious thinkers, even people who would never use those terms, although Soloveitchik comes close, where if you go home and read this essay, he will talk about the phony I. Right? The phony I is Soloveitchik's way of saying, right, the false self. The false self, in other words, is the self that has internalized a whole catalog of needs that are not authentic to who I most fundamentally am. They're about power, they're about control, they're about possessions, they're about prestige. They are not about, Heschel would have said, responsiveness, reciprocity. I don't know if Soloveitchik would embrace that language, but they're not about response to God. They're not about ultimate values. Now, if you're thinking inside the mind of someone who is, and I'm going to use this word, even though it has been totally damaged by how pejorative it has become, by someone who is an apologist for tradition, right? You're going to see Soloveitchik do something totally masterful, right? So here's the question. You raise your hand to Rabbi Soloveitchik and you say, okay, I get it. I get it. So redemption is about expressing my needs and articulating them in words, and through acquiring language, I am redeemed. So if that's the case, why do you script me? I mean, you just told me that I should learn to speak, and now you're telling me exactly what to say. Here's, by the way, there it is. There is the tension of an existentialist thinker totally committed to the authority and, right, power of traditional Jewish observance. Watch him try to do the work of synthesizing them. So what's the argument? He just made it. The argument is that if I let most modern people just say what they think they need, they will end up doing nothing but giving voice to their false self. Or, to invoke language from Heschel from last time, they will make an idolatry of self-expression. And we all know that self-expression tends to be an expression of the false self, and therefore not self-expression at all. Therefore, Soloveitchik argues, what does liturgy do? It teaches me what to need, or better, it teaches me what I already need, were I aware of it. Now, find this totally compelling, find this totally problematic, find this both. I mean, do with it as you will. But the argument here is, it's actually kind of masterful, right? You think, this is kind of all undertone in this essay, you think, oh, I've just walked into a trap. It can't be pulled off, right? You're talking about my expressing my needs. No, but in the end, if you discover your true self, your needs are what the liturgy says. That, Soloveitchik claims, is, and this is kind of this amazing sort of move he makes, why do the rabbis, borrowing from Plato, he would not have said that phrase, why do the rabbis say that every Jewish infant before her birth knows all of Torah and then forgets it? Right? He says, it's sort of an uninteresting thought. Like, what's the payoff? He said, the argument is that what you learn in Torah is your very internal stuff. It is the stuff out of which you are constituted. It's not foreign. So in the process, he then will go on and say, not just of praying, but also of learning, you actually discover, or maybe better, rediscover the true self. And I would suggest that for him, although he doesn't say it this way, the process of rediscovering your true self through speech, through liturgical speech, is redemption. Where I am forbidden to pray for a new car. That's just crude, but there are other things I can pray for, right? That are less crude. Okay. Now, you'll notice something. Actually, you know what? Let me just actually put out a question, which maybe we won't talk about explicitly, but why is Soloveitchik so married to the view that it is about not just speaking my needs, but speaking my needs to and before God? In other words, why prayer and not psychotherapy? Well, maybe we'll come back to that during the discussion afterwards. Now, but I want to ask you for a second to note how totally antithetical this approach is to Heschel's, right? Heschel, we saw last time, says, what is the essence of prayer? What is the meaning of self-transcendence? Not petition, but praise. Right? The essence of prayer is praise. Comes Soloveitchik here and in various essays and says, you know, the essence of prayer is begging God from the heart of my neediness. The essence of prayer is petition. Don't prettify it. Don't be embarrassed by it. The essence of prayer is petition. Now, as I mentioned last time, I think Soloveitchik would claim this is self-transcendence. In two ways. One, in order to beg for something, right, you are essentially confessing your own vulnerability. To actually turn to someone and ask for a basic human need is to declare your lack of self-sufficiency. But further, if we think of self-transcendence as sort of sloughing off the false self that modern culture gives us, so articulating liturgical needs, or articulating needs liturgically, is a form of the nexus of self-transcendence and self-discovery. That is what he calls transcending the phony I. Now, Soloveitchik's essay ends with a classic Soloveitchik move, and I want to just bring our attention to it and then maybe say a couple of closing thoughts. Soloveitchik is a thinker who, in a variety of his essays, especially as he gets older, really sort of dilates on, really emphasizes the dialecticality of all Jewish thought. And in fact, in one essay, he says this really kind of amazing thing. I think it's actually in some ways one of the most interesting paragraphs in 20th century Jewish thought, and most people never see it because it's in a fairly obscure essay. He says in an essay called Majesty and Humility, the Judaic dialectic is unlike the Hegelian in that it knows no synthesis. Right? That Judaism is about articulating pole A and pole B and then saying, welcome to life. Live with them both true at the same time. Now, you know from the title of that essay, one of the things he's talking about is majesty and humility. Right? The human being is infinitely valuable, majestic, and also a shmata and nothing. And as I always like to say, there is no Jewish text that says, oh, okay, so for my sake was the world created, and I am but dust and ashes. Therefore, the conclusion is, I am somewhat important. Right? No Jewish text will ever do that. Rather, it will say, good luck to you. Right? Hold these two thoughts, and go for it. And you see in Soloveitchik this constant preoccupation. Again, the older he gets, this is especially true. It's really not so true in Halachic Man, but it's totally true in his later essays, with polarity, dialectic, these things that can't fully be synthesized living together. So he says, you know, prayer is about acquiring a self. Acquiring a self through redemptive speech. But why do we acquire a self? in order to sacrifice it and give it to God. So the acquisition of self is precisely what makes possible the sacrifice of self. Now, in a way, this goes to the question Rachel Druck mentioned last time, and it goes to this question of the Christian feminist critique of 20th century Christian theology of sin that we talked about last time, right? That is, Christian feminist theologians who approach Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Tillich and say, yeah, sin is too much self. I have never heard a more male construction of sin, right? Female sin is failure to have a self. And we talked about why that might be helpful and not helpful, right? We won't revisit that now. But Soloveitchik, in a way, actually tries to deal with precisely that by talking about a kind of double gesture in prayer, right? First, you have to have a self in order to sacrifice it. And then, of course, we have to get into the discussion of, which is not really developed in this essay, what do we mean by sacrificing the self, right? And is that language that we, I mean, us in this room, would want to embrace in any context, or do we find it scary, dangerous, problematic? We can take that on. For Soloveitchik, it's of a piece with this motif that again becomes more accentuated as he gets older, this increasing preoccupation he has with the Akedah. I have always found it interesting that in certain Jewish thinkers in the 20th century, they can barely go two paragraphs without talking about the Akedah. I mean, try reading Yeshayahu Leibovitz, and like the Akedah is everything. Everything's about the Akedah. Pure submission to God's will. Now, I'll invite you over. You can go through the whole bookcase of Heschel's books, and you'll count the number of times he mentions the Akedah. And if you fill up one hand, I will have failed my test. Right? In other words, interestingly, okay, now why is that interesting? Here's a little one-minute digression, right? Yeshayahu Leibovitz makes the case, Judaism's all about self-transcendence. And what does self-transcendence mean? Leaving all human interests behind. Just obeying God. Just obeying God, right? And those of you who are in my Rabbeinu Bachya class, you've heard me quote this, Leibovitz, dripping with contempt, basically says, everything else, any psychological, sociological benefit that accrues from the religious life is not religion, but social work. It's not interesting, right? Or maybe it's interesting in your little humanistic psychology department, but it has no religious value. The only religious value is sheer obedience to the will of God. That and that alone is self-transcendence. The fundamental text of Jewish theology is the Akedah. What is the Akedah? Realizing, and this is where it begins to get horrific, realizing that even ethics is just a human concern. And so theology is about casting everything else aside but the will of God. Now, how that person also was one of the most outspoken moral critics of the State of Israel is another discussion, right? Okay. Heschel would make exactly the opposite claim, right? What is self-transcendence? The realization that ethics falls on the divine side of the wall and not the human side of the wall. Because what is the fundamental text of Jewish theology for Heschel? Not the Akedah, but the prophets. And what's the meaning of the prophets? If you love God, then the neighbor is the most important thing in the world to you. Now, I had this conversation with someone after the lecture last time. What Heschel would not want us to do is to then say, oh, God is the ethical. Right? That's not what he's saying. He's saying, God is the one who loves the widows and the orphans, and to love God means to care profoundly about the ethical. But it's not to reduce God to that. Heschel is not Levinas. Now, the point is, Soloveitchik, a little bit, if you construct this sort of Leibovitz and Heschel polarity, two people who did not like each other, right? Soloveitchik, I think, in the moments when he emphasizes the Akedah, begins to lean towards
the Leibovitz diet. But then immediately they'll go on to say, but halakha is all about championing the widows and the orphans, and you can't be a posek, you cannot decide Jewish law unless the most important thing in the world to you is being totally unfazed by the powerful and being willing to speak for those who are vulnerable and oppressed. Heschel and Leibovitz are sort of coherent poles. Soloveitchik is a kind of muddy middle on this question. Now, I want to end by saying something that is neo-Soloveitchikian to the core and not Soloveitchik. To my mind, this essay is the best theological argument for reimagining the role of women in Jewish life that has ever been written. Because if identity and dignity and redemption derive from the power of speech, one cannot in good conscience, as a culture, ask women to be quiet, let alone demand that of them. There is an amazing comment. Onklus, one of the sort of standard Aramaic translations of the Torah, translates when in Genesis 2:7, when the Torah says that Adam became a nefesh chaya, a living being. Onklus translates nefesh chaya as ruach mimalala, a spirit that speaks. This totally innovative thing that Onklus says, right? What does it mean to be alive? To talk. Gives new meaning to the term silence equals death, actually, right? If being alive means to talk, then to silence people is essentially, in some sense, to rob them of their life. So, if ultimately, right, theology is taken seriously as more than just sort of interesting ideas we talk about, but is actually that which gives us our marching orders in some sense, then the work of transforming Jewish society in a way that takes 100% of its citizens seriously is actually only, in many ways, at its early stages. And we could, I won't do this now, but we could sort of go through those areas of Jewish communal life and Jewish ritual life, where women have traditionally been told to be quiet, and ask whether this essay does not provide the theological language for the possibility of reimagining who gets to be human in those settings. And I'll just end by saying one thing that I think is absent from this essay that I would have very much wanted to find in here, which is, and maybe this again is a kind of feminist critique, but I don't like that kind of essentialization, right? In an essay that's all about the redemptive power of speech, it would be nice to have at least something also about the redemptive power of learning to listen. And in that sense, Soloveitchik might have, in a way, you know, benefited in this discourse from going back to Buber, where, and the two comments that I've just ended with are actually, they may seem totally separate, but they're actually deeply related. They're about being fully realized human beings is also about learning that you're not the only one who gets to talk. Okay, thank you very much.
You mentioned that the idea of the 19 blessings and having scripted prayer as opposed to unscripted prayer is about getting rid of the false self. Does Soloveitchik at some point go through those 19 blessings and explain why they are the true self? And also tying into what you said at the end, one of the criticisms of from the right of increased women's participation in Judaism is that this is the false self, and this is ego speaking as opposed to true need. Why wouldn't Soloveitchik take that tack instead?
Well, okay, so for the first answer is, I don't know, because we don't yet have everything that Soloveitchik wrote. And it's actually a complicated methodological question, meaning in terms of major theological statements, Soloveitchik basically published a handful of those in his life. And now a sort of major debate among Soloveitchik students and actually within his family is the many, many volumes of full papers that he wrote and didn't publish, would he want us to be reading those? And the decision has been made. They're all out there. I haven't seen him do that, but I also am not finished with all 11 volumes, I think, that have come out in the last decade. But I don't think so. I actually think, I may be wrong here, I think he might have found that a task almost too easy to need doing, which might sound really strange to you and to me too in certain ways, but like, in that sense, he's so living within a traditional Jewish theological vocabulary that those things are sort of muvanim elehem in some way. They're sort of self-understood. Now, hang on one second. Now, the second question of, would he have taken that tack? So, you know, is what I said the only conclusion for meeting this essay? I think it's not, right? That said, Soloveitchik made a very dramatic decision, basically by fiat, right, to bring women's voices into the Beit Midrash, right? And he did it without a responsum, right? There's no tshuva, without conferring with lots of people. He just did it. And basically, single-handedly, he created this dramatic transformation in women's role within Orthodoxy. Now, I think what he did not anticipate, and this is true about many people who created opportunities for women to learn in Orthodoxy, they basically thought they could create opportunities for women to learn, and that would ultimately be enough. Right? And in some instances, it worked out that way, and in some instances, it didn't. Right? Now, this is not me talking, okay? This is not me talking. Now you have all kinds of desecrations, like partnership minyanim, people called rabbah, maharat, all kinds of insanity, right? Because patachta pela satan, right? You have basically created an opening. Once you create an opening, right? The classic argument of every traditionalist in every culture, it is a slippery slope, right? And the truth is, often they're right. The question is, what's the morally courageous position to take about a slippery slope? Do you always avoid it, or do you get on and hold on tight? That's a question, right? So I'm not sure he would have shunned what I said. He would be appalled by how far I'd like to take it. But the fact is, in a certain way, he played out the same logic. I mean, women were not learning Gemara till he basically did it. Joshi and then Eric. I feel like we've turned the students here into Phil Donahue. It's so great. Yeah. Okay. Mostly you probably don't know who Phil Donahue was, but yeah, go ahead.
So I think I have a two-part question, and I think also about both Heschel and Soloveitchik. And the first part is why pray with other people? And the second part of the question, which I guess is probably the part that I'm more interested in, is to what extent is prayer a model for acting toward other people in the world? And I'm not sure if those two questions are connected. But obviously, given what you already said about Heschel and God not necessarily being, and the ethical is not God. God is sort of like the reason for the ethical to exist in the world. Like, given that, to what extent is prayer, according to both of them?
Okay, so the first... Now I just conflated the two questions in my head. The first question about why pray in a community, I mean, I think I tried to talk about that a little bit explicitly last time, which is part of discovering your true self is actually not becoming a totally self-isolated unit. Or let me put that in a slightly different way. Part of self-transcendence is actually learning to say we.
And
right.
True for Soloveitchik too?
I think it is true for Soloveitchik. Yeah, I mean, there's something about praying as the people Israel. You know, Heschel, in a kind of, I think not a sentence he would have sort of defended all the way if pushed, makes the comment in passing, Judaism doesn't believe in I and thou, it believes in we and thou. I think if you pushed him, he would have said, Judaism believes in a kind of back and forth motion, the I and thou in the context of the we and thou. Right? There has to be room for the self, because we don't want to end up in a totalitarian place where all there is the collective. But we certainly don't want to end up in a place where it's just me and God, because then, again, like Judaism consistently, the prophets are all about rejecting that. And Soloveitchik explicitly does reject that, right? I mean, he doesn't sort of like focus on it as ferociously and consistently as Heschel, but it's very much part of his thought. So that's the first piece, right? There's a kind of self-transcendence that comes from learning to say we. In terms of, is it a model? I'm not totally sure I know what you mean by that, but I'm not sure Soloveitchik really thought in those kind of terms, but on the other hand, he does talk about marriage in this way, as about the human being overcoming isolation through becoming a communing being. And it's actually very important that he uses the language communing being, not just speaking being, because that suggests some degree of relationality. It may even suggest some degree of listening, even though I sort of said it sort of critically at the end. He does imagine that marriage creates a kind of bridge across kind of an otherwise series of isolated selves. And I think it's possible for us to make the argument that what he says about marriage may potentially be true about other relationships as well, right? That there's something transformative. Now, I think, though, that in light of what you said, it's an interesting moment to reflect for a second about why is talking to God different than talking to your therapist, right? And it's interesting because in other essays, he talks about how talking to God is really the only solution to loneliness. And I think what he means by that, I think, okay, I'm totally kind of speculating here, but if you think of the notion that we are bereft of an ontic fulcrum, right, lost and thrown in the world, the problem with talking to other people is that they can't provide a fulcrum. They can sort of hold our hands as we vulnerably move through time together. But what, in his mind, prayer allows us to do is to sort of, I don't know, tap into, connect to the one thing that is truly the ground of our being. In other words, God provides a foundation that nothing else does. Now, this is one of the ways, okay, so here we can just say, we're doing a class in 20th century intellectual thought, you could say, for a non-religious existentialist, this is where religious existentialists actually throw in the towel of existentialism and, you know, end up in a cloud of hope and relationship and love, right? Of course, if you read Soloveitchik, he'll say, if you think that having a relationship with God is all about hope, love, and a wonderful bed of roses, he doesn't say this, but you should try living in my psyche, right? I mean, it's all kinds of torment and tempestuousness and divine hiddenness and all kinds of other stuff. But what I could imagine someone like Camus reading Soloveitchik and say, oh, you're bereft of an ontic fulcrum. Oh, lo and behold, you go to shul and you found one. Good for you. Right? Right? And Soloveitchik saying something back like, well, I'm not really interested in making a god or an ideal out of my own loneliness. Right? Why have you decided before we even start that loneliness is not just the beginning of the human condition, but the end of it too? That seems strangely romanticizing of our own mishigas. Camus is a bad example for that. I think he'd be happier saying that to Sartre. Camus was like a good guy, right? But so, no, so I mean, but I think that's the case. The argument is that the existentialists, religious existentialists like to flatter themselves and say, oh, you know, we have it the hardest because, you know, we live with God. And other existentialists often say, yeah, nice try, right? And ultimately, that's going to be a kind of predilection, how you come down on that question. Eric, and then Jenna.
I don't have any fights to pick with you today. I love what you said about Frederick Douglass, by the way.
About what?
About Frederick Douglass. I teach Frederick Douglass, and I hadn't thought of that. But I was surprised at the very beginning of the lecture, and I'm sure it's my own ignorance that led to my surprise. When you called Soloveitchik the most important Orthodox philosopher, and you didn't feel any need to modify the word Orthodox. So I'm wondering if you could just educate me a little bit about where Soloveitchik fits in regarding what I understand to be an enormous variety of orthodoxies.
Okay. Every question I'm ever asked in one of these talks, it like requires like a month of a seminar to do. Let me say what I meant. I'll give you the most modest version, and then I'll scramble for something else to add. When I said philosopher, I actually meant philosopher. In other words, I meant among Orthodox thinkers who read philosophers, he was far and away the most sophisticated and influential. Now, does that mean that everyone who jostles for the word Orthodox would regard him that way? No, many people to his right regarded him as heretical would be very strong, but deeply misguided on some really fundamental issues. Zionism, secular education, women's participation in learning. There are many people who had very blistering things to say about him. I was not including in that. I mean, in some ways you could say, you know, the most important 20th century Orthodox philosophers are people who largely didn't read philosophy. The Chazon Ish, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. There's a lot of figures you could mention in that way. I was actually trying to make, in a way, a more limited claim that not everyone who thinks about Judaism and modernity is exactly a modern thinker in the way that I have in mind. In that sentence. So, it may just be a failure of my locution, but among those people who have engaged modernity, but by the way, I mean, I could say a lot of things here that, you know, would not make me a lot of friends. I actually think one of the things that has happened as a result in certain segments of communities that identify as Orthodox, right, is this feeling that we no longer have to confront philosophical questions because Soloveitchik confronted them for us. Soloveitchik becomes a kind of vicarious excuse to not engage all kinds of questions. Right, which I think is a whole interesting cultural phenomenon, and I can't actually think of anyone who quite has the same kind of role in Jewish life. I would disagree with that. I think I don't think there's anywhere near the same number of people. Nigel, you're an exception here. Who regard Jonathan Sacks as that kind of Rebbe that because he's had this thought, I don't have to think about it anymore. I've never heard anyone say that about Jonathan Sacks, right? I mean, in other words, if you think about the ways in which, Soloveitchik dealt with biblical criticism in a little passage in two sentences in The Lonely Man of Faith, therefore the issue is sort of, it's been dealt with. Jonathan Sacks will never have that kind of authority. And by the way, one of the reasons for that is, and with all due respect to Jonathan Sacks, one of the things that allowed Soloveitchik to be Soloveitchik was that he also was one of the giant Talmudists of the 20th century. Jonathan Sacks is not that. He's something else. Quite wonderful in some ways. No, you know what I'm saying? In other words, that's the irony, right? Soloveitchik was able to do it for all kinds of reasons, right? Other people... If someone who wasn't the kind of towering Talmudic figure had said some of the things he said and read some of the people he read, I'm not sure. Or for that matter, if he hadn't had the last name Soloveitchik, was in itself is an interesting thing, right? He had crazy yichus, which helped. So I actually don't think they're parallel really at all. Janet, is this somebody online? Great, let's let someone online talk.
I guess I don't get to ask my own questions. I have to only ask these. Okay, so a question from the online audience is, for Soloveitchik and or Heschel, is there any expectation of response from God? Is the redemption that we experience only internal that allows us to act, but without reciprocity from God?
I can sort of evade the question slash answer it by saying that in this essay, Soloveitchik is not interested in that question. Meaning, that's not the work he's doing here. Now, if you were to ask, does Soloveitchik ultimately think that God will redeem the world? I think the answer is dramatically yes. But does he expect reciprocity in the sense of, I'm going to beg and God's going to do? I don't know. That does not seem to be where the sort of center his attention, the center of his attention is in these essays. He might have said something that some people would argue is the best answer possible, and others would, I think, experience it as an evasion. The reciprocity that God gives is God's presence and willingness to listen. Right? The fact that God is shomea tefillah, as he says, I believe, in this essay and in others, that is the answer. And we're going to see a version of that next time when we talk about two sort of lesser-known 20th century figures. We're going to see, right, that it's precisely the notion of being heard by God rather than being answered and saved by God that is what's kind of at the center of concern. And again, you can sort of decide, well, look, that's not a theological desideratum. It's not something I want. It's just the reality of living after the Holocaust and in a century of mass slaughter. Like, I don't know exactly how to talk about God answering my prayers. And even when I talk about God answering my prayers, if I'm thoughtful, then I have to deal with the fact that God didn't answer someone else's prayers. Right? That's why, I mean, by the way, this is just me talking. Sometimes it sort of gives me the willies when someone says things like, there but for the grace of God go I. Oh, so someone else got hit by a car. Great. Glad your prayer worked, theirs didn't. I mean, right? In other words, there's consequences there that are quite serious to deal with. But again, as I suggested, I think that what Soloveitchik and Heschel in different ways would have argued is, it's not just that we're dealing with a sort of bidiavad, this is what the 20th century wrought. It's also a sense that that's what religious maturation would be, right? We don't want to live as mature human beings in a world in which God is basically, you know, the babysitter who stops the game every time the kids stop fighting. And I don't mean to use a sort of crude metaphor, because I think there are ways to obviously critique that metaphor very strongly. But I think they would say that that is part of what it means to mature. You have versions of that in Chazal already. That's why the rabbis like Purim rather than Pesach in certain ways. You have that in Chassidut. You have that in 20th century theology in various ways. My own teacher, Yitz Greenberg, is a version of that, right? The maturation of the covenant. So it's not just, oh, God let us down, therefore let's theologize around it. It's actually about, this is an opportunity for theological maturation, for actually becoming an adult who's not constantly sort of held on a leash. Okay, we'll take the last, Benji, and then we'll...
I think what I find too hopeful about the ideas is the faith in language. Some of the existentialism that I found most appealing is very much, you know, expresses the idea that our deepest wants and feelings are inexpressible, that they're ineffable. And I wonder how Soloveitchik would respond to the teaching attributed to the Kotzke that nothing screams out like silence, and that actually he's sort of doing an injustice to our deepest needs by suggesting that there's any script, wherever it's come from, that can express them.
So, if you'll permit me, I'm going to play with your question a little bit, okay? And say the following. What you just said, I think Heschel would have embraced 100%, right? Because Heschel's claim is that ultimately what is most meaningful is ineffable. And what is most powerfully real cannot be expressed. Where Heschel goes very far with that is in the suggestion, right, that all kinds of really deep experiences that we have are pre-linguistic and preconceptual. And as I think I mentioned last time, right, that has not survived the last generation of philosophy. It simply hasn't survived. Soloveitchik, in contrast, I think if you follow him through his corpus, in dramatic antithesis to Heschel, seems to think that human beings are linguistic all the way down. They are linguistic everything is constituted linguistically. And probably you and I would want to find some way of articulating some happy medium between those two things that no one has ever fully been able to articulate, right? And by the way, I think that that's why they end up where they do on questions of interfaith dialogue. That is to say that for Heschel, because he is committed to the notion that there is all this preconceptual, pre-linguistic religious experience, he then is able to argue, in my opinion, extremely problematically, philosophically, that, oh, well, all kinds of people across all kinds of religious traditions share fundamentally the same pre-linguistic experience, and then there's sort of language that's placed on it, right? And that allows him to sort of talk about, you know, Jews and Christians, we share the same fundamental postures, etc., etc. Soloveitchik, as you may know, if you've ever read, let's say, Confrontation, right, says, Epremistabra, right? The opposite is the case. We can't talk about anything because we live in different languages. We can't talk about anything ultimate, right? Because we live in different languages. And because we're linguistic all the way down, ironically, our capacity to communicate is limited. That's one of the great ironies, right, of Soloveitchik versus Heschel, right? Soloveitchik, who is such a linguistic thinker, believes that dialogue becomes impossible because language is inherently particularizing, right? Whereas Heschel makes the case, he certainly didn't think about this in a kind of philosophical way, I don't think, but precisely because so much is non-linguistic, communication is possible. Many people sort of valorize, celebrate Heschel for being a kind of pathbreaker in interfaith dialogue. I think it's purchased at a cost of not being all that philosophically sophisticated about the linguistic nature of a lot of our experience. But to actually answer your question, I don't know what Soloveitchik would say to that. Meaning, I don't recall any place where he actually explores that question of, like, what remains inexpressible. This essay, if you read this whole essay, it's very much this kind of progression. It's silence to scream to voice. Voice meaning words. The progression from silence to Moshe to Aaron in the language of the Zohar. And he doesn't seem to explore the possibility of what about that which will forever elude language? Like, you sort of wonder, had Soloveitchik read some of the literature on pain? Right? The incommunicability of pain. Right? Had Soloveitchik ever read Elaine Scarry? Right? The body in pain. Right? The inability to actually find a way to express what it means to be in pain to another human being. So does that mean someone in pain can't be redeemed? Maybe that's the argument. I don't know. But I'm not sure he lo yarad le'omkam shel dvarim, right? I'm not sure he really, right, entered into the depth of this question. I think what you end up having is certain kind of predilections in Heschel and Soloveitchik that continue their way all the way through their worldview and are not, as far as I see, called into question by either of them in either direction. So, okay. I'm happy to talk to people more, but I want to let people go home. Thank you very much.